reading comes from Matthew 15, 21 through 28. And as Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon, and behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and was crying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon." But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came and begged him, saying, "Send her away, for she is crying out after us." He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, help me." And he answered, "It is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." She said, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Then Jesus answered her, "O woman, great is your faith. Be it done for you as you desire." And her daughter was healed instantly. This is the word of the Lord.
Well, it is very good to be back with you tonight. I had a good time away. A number of you have asked about how the swim team ended up, and I want to thank you. You know, All Souls this past 3 years has given to this Emerald Youth Swim Team. And the season wraps up this weekend. 2 weeks ago I was gone, and the kids did a wonderful job. So many of you have helped. It's really meant so much. Taryn coached 20 little kids most nights. Let's see, Katie helped with the little ones. The Duncans helped administer things. I think I see Davis and Brittany back there. They were a part of it. Gary Peacock, who runs the CHOP, who sang that beautiful song, the Campus House of Prayer, had a fundraiser and decided to give $1,000 to the swim team. And the children, people ask, "Well, how fast are you swimming, or how well are you going?" And I usually reframe the question. You know, the answer is not very fast, but the success is that children in our community that would never have been at a swim meet are now at a swim meet, and that's a good thing. So we end on Tuesday. We take 40 little ones to Dollywood Water Country or something like that. So I don't know what it's called. So hashtag God help me. So be praying for that. And the coach, Justin, and I agreed that if we could get through the season, we challenge each other to swim a 10K race Friday morning. So from 6 to 9-ish. So if you think of praying, I will be trying to swim 10,000 meters that time. Last week was wonderful, too. We saw our daughter perform up in Albany, and that was great. And I got to listen, hear about the services, just so encouraged by what's been happening as we've been away. And as I listened to Daryl and as I talked to Judge and heard you, I just was really impressed with their faith and the faith that came out in their sermons. And Daryl and I are starting to spend a good bit of time together. Daryl Arnold is a pastor of Overcoming Believers Church, if you're a guest, and it's a powerful African-American church over on the east side. And whenever I'm with him, my faith increases. And I noticed that when I listened to him preach, just his faith, the faith seemed to well up as I was listening. You know, and that is one of the odd things about faith. It's not static. It ebbs and it flows. Sometimes we have a lot of faith. Sometimes we have a little bit of faith. Sometimes we have no faith. I had a good conversation with a friend who said, "I want to have faith. I just cannot have faith." Sometimes Jesus commends great faith. Sometimes he questions lack of faith. So faith ebbs and flows. I don't know what number you got when you looked at the thermometer during prayer. I was a 3.5. And I kept saying, "Lord, come on, I've got to preach here in a minute. Can we get at least above 5? And he said, "Nope, you're a 3.5, son." And it's been a 3.5 summer. And that's just kind of where I am. And one of the things that I asked you all to pray for before we went on vacation, 3 days at the Smoky Mountain Swim Meet is not a vacation. Before we went away from this responsibility, was that we'd pray for burning hearts, that our hearts would awaken with greater faith. And I sense that's been happening. You know, when you think about someone with great faith, I was thinking, what is the difference? There's some people that I meet and I think, this is a great woman. This is a great singer. This is a great leader. But there's other people I meet and I think, this person serves a great God. Do you know what I mean by that? There's a difference. And when I'm with a Daryl or a judge, I think, geez, they really serve a great God. So how do you awaken faith? How do you move up the thermometer? Well, this story, which admittedly has some bumpy parts to it, is a story about that. And it begins with Jesus. The context here is a very busy season of ministry. He's been having a lot of hassles with the religious authorities. He's been performing a lot of miracles. The crowds are coming to him. And it says Jesus withdraws. And he went away to the district of Tyre and Sidon. And what that means is outside of Israel. And that's important to the story. Because at that point, now Tyre and Sidon are in Lebanon, but it's a big region in the northwest of the Galilee. And it was not Israel. It was not Jewish territory. It was territory held by people of other religions. And Jews did not go there. When I was traveling over there, there were big signs that marked the minefields that kept you from going up towards Syria and Lebanon. And obviously those signs weren't there then, but it was the same kind of social markings that you just don't go there. So to read this story in the first century would have been, he went where to withdraw? And I think the reason why was he couldn't find a place in Israel to rest. He realized he was exhausted, needed recharging, and so he goes into what they would have derisively called pagan land. That's kind of what it was named. And this has nothing to do with the point of the sermon, but I want to just throw this out to you. Some of you need to withdraw. You're tired, you're exhausted. You can't find the right place to do it. And so you're not. And may I suggest to you that you might even go to pagan land. There might be somewhere that you could find to get some rest. And that's what Jesus did. Well, when he's there, there's a very interesting encounter he has with a woman whose daughter is severely oppressed by a demon. And, you know, it's interesting that there's only one word in the New Testament that kind of covers all these problems, and they call it demon possession or demon oppressed. And sometimes it's clear it deals with someone who has a wicked spirit, you know, afflicting them, and Jesus casts out the spirit. But other times it appears that they use this word for epileptic fits, perhaps, and maybe all sorts of mental illness. Because, of course, in the first century, you didn't have categories and words like schizophrenia and things like that. So it's a big word that covers everything from demon possession to all sorts of mental and emotional disturbances. And so, I don't know, I try to read with some imagination, and I was just wondering, maybe this mom who doesn't have a husband with her, and that probably means she's a single mom, maybe she has a daughter with a mental illness. I just kind of imagined the passage that way. I think I've been thinking about that. I take Monday mornings, usually one of the ways I try to seek the peace of the city is I write a little column for the paper, and I try to identify areas in the community where there's a shalom gap, where God's desires and the reality are kind of set apart, and I just try to write about it and bring it to the community's attention. And so when I was taking a tour of the jail last year, Randy Nichols, the district attorney, said, "Welcome to the new lakeshore." And I thought, "What do you mean?" And he explained that this is now where we put a lot of the mentally ill people in our... Jeez, Louise, sorry. This is where we put mentally ill people... And if not there, the mission. So I've been thinking a lot about this, and I met a woman who, the son developed a very severe bipolar disorder as a young man. And when he was on meds, he was manageable, but when he was off his meds, he became very violent. And this woman's life was a horror story. The poor child was in jail 6 times, and when he turned 18, of course, the law in Tennessee is that there's nothing you can do to coerce them to take their medication. And so she had to put four locks on her bedroom door because she was afraid he would kill her. And she's lived this way for quite a few years now. She's a very sweet woman. And I wonder if the woman in our story is sort of like that woman. You know, I can't imagine. It's hard enough to have a child with a mental disability in our culture, but in the first century, it had to be just horrific. And Roger Noe, the former head of the School of Social Work, gave me a book. It was called Is There No Place for Me? And if you're interested in this kind of thing, it's very good. It won the Pulitzer Prize, I think, in 83. It's a story of Sylvia Frumkin. She was very schizophrenic, spent her life in psychotic hospitals. And at the end of the book, one of the things that she does is she interviews her mother, and her mother says that having a daughter like Sylvia is a shanda, which is Yiddish for disgrace. So there's this real social stigma that comes along with mental illness and or demon possession or whatever is going on. And so this woman that we're introduced to here, she probably has a violently disturbed child. This child, you know, when we first moved here, you could walk by Lakeshore and hear screams. You obviously can't. Well, you can now, except for their kids playing soccer. But there were moans and screams that would come out of the asylum all hours of the day and night. And that's probably what this woman's life is like. This child is probably moaning, screaming, cutting herself, throwing herself into fires, probably threatening to kill her. So this is a woman who a child nobody wants around. And so she's cut off entirely from all the resources of her community. She's exhausted. She's desperate. And Jesus will say at the end of the story that this woman has great faith. And if we're asking, what is that and where does it come from? It has something to do with desperation. Great faith comes from great desperation. And I don't know about you, that's not my favorite posture. And I'd ask you to think tonight about an area in your life where you feel great desperation. You know, maybe everything else is going well, but maybe this is an area you just feel like, I have no hope. I have no resources. I cannot solve this problem. I just can't. Well, as hard as that is, that's a gift because it can help us develop great faith. Another thing you see in this dear woman is great vision, and that just amazes me. This woman has not written off her daughter. And isn't that easy to do when you're struggling with someone and maybe someone's incapacitated or not being the kind of person you wanted them to be? It's so easy to just write them off, give up on them. She could have abandoned this child emotionally, certainly physically. But she hears about this healer and she goes and seeks him out because she has a vision that God, she doesn't even seem to know God that well, but God could do something in this little girl's life. And she violates every cultural taboo of the day. She's a woman. Jewish rabbis are not supposed to talk to women. She's a Canaanite. That was the people who were the enemy of Israel. And she has a demonized daughter. Those are three things that say don't go anywhere near a Jewish rabbi. And she's a mom with a sick kid. You know, there's no more powerful force in the world than a mother with a sick kid. And she does not care. Because she has a vision that God could do something. I ask you again to think about that desperate situation, you know, where you've just said, it's done. Maybe it's your marriage. Maybe it's your singleness. Maybe it's your relationship with a parent, physical problem, financial problem, your barrenness. I was praying about this recently, about an area in my life, and I just realized I had no vision. I just flatlined. And I had accepted something as God's will when it wasn't. Have you ever done that? I mean, part of it's a coping mechanism, right? I mean, sometimes things are hard in life. You have to accept hard things. I get that. But it's not good when you lose vision for another person or situation. It's just not good. I think that's when a marriage dies, is when one of the parties loses vision for their spouse. I think that's when a relationship dies. When you just, I just don't have vision for you anymore. This is just the way it's going to be. Just the way it's going to be. So if that's where you are tonight, ask God to give you a vision. What does he want to do in this situation? Well, she finally makes her way to Jesus. And she calls him the Son of David, which was a messianic term. We don't know how much she knew about the Hebrew Scriptures. She heard people talking about him. He'd been healing a few miles away. She knows something about him. And she trusts him. She may not have all her doctrine right, but she trusts him. She's heard, come hell or high water, she's going to get her kid prayed for by this healer. That's what mamas do. You know, great faith also has to have a great object. You know, as a pastor, I'm often in crisis situations, and in a lot of them, particularly if people aren't oriented towards faith, people will say, you know, you just got to have faith. You just got to have faith. And I kind of wince and think, well, faith in what? There's got to be a what, right? People say, it'll all work out. Well, why would you think that? Great faith needs a great object, and this woman has a great Jesus for her object. And here is where I struggle with a story like this. I love these stories. I believe these stories. I believe with everything in me that Jesus Christ did exactly what this text says, that he healed this woman with a word. I believe that with all my heart. But here's where I struggle, is I don't often see him heal that way today. Now, I believe he can. I've seen the miraculous, but not very often. Frankly, normally when I hear about it, it happened in Africa. And I just haven't seen instantaneous, miraculous healing like this that often. And so what can happen is, and I think this happens at a subconscious level, you get a story like this, you believe it, you don't see things like this happen today, and so you do something in your head that says, maybe it just doesn't work that way anymore. Maybe I just need to be a good moral person and that sort of thing. And you become kind of a practical deist. You tuck Jesus away way up there. It's kind of like he got tired or something. I don't know what you do intellectually, but it's just like he's just is sort of not in that business anymore of actually moving in my life. And What I'd suggest to you is that he's very much in that business anymore, except for it is often in less dramatic ways. I think of a friend that I know that has he's dropping money over the church right now. Hallelujah! You know.
Oh, where were we?
I have a friend who has a mentally ill son, has prayed for him for years. The son was not instantaneously healed. The son suffered horribly, as did the family. The son went through a bizarre experience with the mental health care system. Read the book Crazy if you're interested in learning more about that. But today, through prayer, therapy, good meds, good conversation, godly parents, son has a job, significant relationship, the parents' marriage is deeper, the family's relationship is deeper as they've all pulled together, their faith is growing. I would suggest to you that that's Jesus. I mean, I like the instantaneous thing better. But this is the way that he appears to do it. And what I want to suggest to you, and I think he does miracles. But what I want to suggest to you is, have you become faithless? Have you stopped having a big enough Jesus to believe that somehow, in some way, he could work in the situation where you feel so stuck? And I don't mean by that give you everything you want. That's not where I'm going with this. Because a lot of times, boy, he doesn't, right? We all know that, right? But he does move. He does change. He does transform. Do you still believe that? Great faith has a great object. Well, the disciples try to shoo her away as kind of a nuisance. And honestly, it makes me think of my walk home tonight. You know, I'm sure I'll pass a homeless guy or two. Who has some kind of psychotic problem. And they'll ask me for money. I'll ask them if I can take them to the mission. They'll say no, and I'll shoo them away. Jesus says, I was sent only for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Jesus came for the Jews. His ministry is restricted to Israel before the Passion. After his resurrections, he widens the scope of his mission. He says, go into every nation and preach the gospel, but not before the cross. Before the cross, he focuses on Israel. This is the only time he goes outside of Israel in his ministry. And the mother doesn't seem to care about the theology lesson and falls at his feet. Says, Lord, have mercy. And then Jesus says, it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. That's not a nice thing for Jesus to say. This is just Jesus behaving badly. This was common language at that time. The Jews saw themselves as God's children. They saw everyone else as dogs. Jesus is saying that he came to nourish Israel, that he's not come to meet the needs of the Gentiles. That will come later. He is just baldly stating it, and he calls the woman a dog. What's going on? Well, I read a bunch of commentaries to see what people would do with this, because we don't like it when Jesus doesn't behave well. This was my favorite one. Jesus said this with a twinkle in his eye. How do you say this with a twinkle? You know, I no, 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 no. The Greek word for dog really refers to puppy. No. The more I study Scripture, the less I feel the need to tame Jesus. I have no idea why he said this. I think it was rude. But he said it. Now, what we do know is the woman responds. She says, "Yes, Lord, even the dogs eat crumbs that fall from the master's table." What a great response. Great. She almost outfoxes him there. You know, it's just a beautiful response. It's a beautiful conversation that's unfolding here. I don't know why he does this, but I know this story sounds a lot like my prayer life. Can you relate to this? Where you're asking and you're asking, and Jesus just seems to be like on another project. I'm sorry, Doug, I'm just busy today. I don't have time for you. But she persists and keeps asking. And this is one of the oddest things about the biblical teaching on prayer, is somehow Jesus seems to like us to annoy him with these requests. And he tells stories about that, right? Luke 18, a widow keeps coming to a judge for justice. The judge says, "Get out of here." And finally she wears him down. He gives in, and Luke introduces a parable. And he told them a parable to the effect that they ought always to pray and not lose heart. And then Luke 11, he tells a story about a man who goes to a neighbor at midnight to ask for bread. The neighbor says, "Go away." The guy keeps asking. Finally, the neighbor gives in. Jesus concludes the story. He says, "Ask and you'll receive. Seek and you'll find. Knock and the door will be opened." And the Greek verbs could be rendered, keep asking, keep seeking, keep knocking. So the point in these stories is not that God is grumpy. The point in these stories is God wants us to be persistent in our faith, and to keep come back, and to keep coming back, and to keep coming back until we know it's not his will to answer the prayer. I don't know why. I've got a bunch of books on my shelves that explain why. I don't know why. He says, keep asking me. If I can think of any biblical story at all that suggests why he would do that, it's the one of Jacob wrestling with the angel. He just seems to want to get into it with us. I have a friend who likes to pick fights with his wife. And I said, "Why do you do that?" He says, "God, I never feel so close to her as when we fight." And then he says something else I'm not going to say in the pulpit. But there's just something about a good wrestling match that brings us close. And Jesus seems to want us to do that with him. Great faith has great persistence. Now, there is a time, and this, I think this requires great discernment and spiritual direction and counsel. There is a time when Jesus says, "No, you're asking the wrong prayer." See, I'm not saying that if you ask long enough, you'll get whatever you want. I know that's not what the Bible teaches. What I'm saying is, he wants us to ask and ask and ask and ask until he tells you to stop asking. And usually you know. I mean, I've known. Well, the last thing that is just so striking about this woman, she's got this great desperation. Her faith has a great vision for her daughter. Her faith has a great object in Jesus. Her faith has great persistence. The last thing is just great humility. I mean, I think what Jesus said was offensive to her. And here's where I thought two writers were helpful. One said, she's not saying, "Lord, give me what I deserve on the basis of my goodness." She's saying, "Give me what I don't deserve on the basis of your goodness." Isn't that good? To me, that's understanding of grace. I'll say that again. Lord, give... She's not saying, Lord, give me what I deserve on the basis of my goodness. She is saying, give me what I don't deserve on the basis of your goodness. And then another says, she does not dispute the justice of the mysterious ways by which God works out his divine purpose. All she knows is that her daughter is grievously tormented, that she needs supernatural help, that here in the person of the Lord, the Son of David, is one who can give her that help. I think that's where we want to get with our faith. And this, I think, is really the heart and the core of great faith, is when you realize how powerless you really are. I know that sounds like a pulpit cliche, but it really is the essence of faith when you get to the point like Judge got after 20 years of sexual addiction, when he realizes, I cannot heal myself. Great faith begins with great humility. You know, I can't help but contrast Judge's powerful story of his time. I think the facility is called Pure Life. And once another friend had gone to a rehab facility. He was really struggling and been there a long time, $20,000 a month and all this stuff. And we were praying and gets out. And somebody said, what'd you learn? And he said, my wife really blanked me over. I thought, you didn't learn a thing. If you came out of that and that's your response, you didn't learn a thing. The Greek Orthodox Church reads this ancient stories on days commemorating female martyrs, acknowledging perhaps that great faith always results in great faithfulness, if not the great results that we had hoped for. Let's pray.